Hi. I should say first, this is a joint work with Pablo Barceló and Leonid Litkin from the University of Toronto, and Ronald Thing from IBM Almaden. So, we have this week many talks on data exchange, so I'm not going to say why this is a relevant, important, interesting problem on database theory. But let me just show you some slides about data exchange so that you remember what are the main concepts on this area. Actually, so what we consider here are data exchange of this form. So here we have S, T, and sigma sub S T. S is a source schema, T is a target schema, and sigma sub S T is a set of source to target dependencies. And here we have a difference from the data exchange settings that Fokion and Colaitis introduced. Here we have source to target dependencies of this form, where five of S, where this formula is a first order formula over the source. So here we have more than just conjunctions of atoms over the source. And here we have a formula of this form that there exists a Y, such that this formula here, size of T, and this is a conjunction of atoms over the target. And notice that here, well, we generalize these data chain settings to consider first order formulas over the source, because all the results that Fagin, Colaitis, Miller, and Popper obtained are also true for this kind of source to target dependencies. But here, we have to impose the restriction that we just have conjunctions of atoms. Yeah. Okay, so let me give you a simple example. So for example, this is a data exchange setting. In the source, we have just one table, employee, and here we store the name of the employees. And in the target, we have department, and we have, in this case, two parameters. This is the name of the employee, and this is a department number, for example. And we have one source of target dependencies that says that for every employee in the source, we should find a department in the target. Yeah, very simple example. So what is the data exchange problem, or what is the main problem in this area? Is the problem of finding solutions or materializing the source instance. So given a source instance I, the main problem is find a target instance j such that ij satisfies sigma sub st. And as Fokion and your Gottlob were shown in their talks, I mean, we call them this j's, or this materialization, the solutions for I. Okay, and here we have a simple example. For example, if we just have one employee, Peter, then we have many possible solutions. So for example, in one solution, we can say that Peter works in department one. In a different solution, we can say that it works in department one and also works in department two, for example. There is no information not to believe that Peter works in two different departments, or we can say that also we have another employee, John, which works in department one. And we have other solutions that are quite interesting, that there are solutions where we use null values. And in this case, basically what we are saying is that Peter works in a department, but we don't know exactly in which department, okay? So what is the problem that we want to, what is another fundamental problem in data exchange is the problem of, is the query answering problem. So what is the idea here? Well, we have a query Q over the target schema, and remember that what we have materialized is the source instance. And what we want to compute is an answer to this query posed over the target. So what does it mean to answer Q? Well, if you think about this, actually, since we only have materialized the source instance, we will use a certain answer semantics for this query. So basically what we are saying here is the following. Okay, if we have the source instance and we pose a query over the target, what we are going to do is we take all the solutions for this instance, then they compute the answer to this query in all these solutions, and then we take the intersection. This is a certain answer. So basically we are saying this answer, or this tuple, is going to be an answer to this query in all possible solutions. So we are sure that this is going to be in the possible materialized solution. So for example, just let me give you two simple examples. If we say, for example, this query, in this case we have two free variables, x and y, and we say department of x, y, in this case we obtain as a certain answer the empty set, because if you think about the previous case, so for example, if you do the intersection of all these solutions, we obtain the empty set. We have more solutions, actually, but just this is enough to see that we'll get the empty set. But we can obtain some information. So for example, if we say there exists a Y such that department of XY, so here what we are saying is give me the list of employees. And remember that in the source instance we have employee Peter. What we see is that Peter is going to be in all the solutions. Yeah. So, for example, John is going to be in some solution, but it's not going to be in other solutions. So, but Peter is going to be in all the solutions. So, it's a certain answer in this case. So, how we can compute these certain answers? So, the naive algorithm does not work. We have infinitely many solutions, so we cannot compute all the solutions, then compute all the answers in all the solutions, and then take the intersection. So what is the Fain, Colaitis, Miller, and Popa propose an approach to solve this problem, and this approach is query rewriting. So the idea is look for some specific transformation, and what is this transformation? It's just a function that takes a source instance and produces a target instance. So for example, it takes a source instance and produces the canonical solution, or produces the core. We will see, I mean, what are all these elements, but they were mentioned in Fokion's tutorial. And once you look, once you choose this specific transformation, then find conditions under which certain of qi is the same as q prime of f of I. So what I'm saying is, in order to compute the certain answers, what you have to do is, well, you have to pose, or you have to construct this instant, this target instant f of I, for example, the core, and they have to, then you have to evaluate a particular query over the core. Okay? So that's the approach. So for example, we will see the result later, but for example, for conjunctive queries, this is going to work. You can take the query and then you can pose exactly the same query but over the canonical, for example. Okay? So and a natural question here is, well, what is a good alternative for f? So we have the canonical, we have the core, can we have other transformations that are good? Okay, so let me give you the outline of this talk and actually what are we going to see here. So the problem that we want to study here is query rewriting, actually. We want to study this technique. And, well, first of all, I'm going to talk a bit about query rewriting over the canonical solution. What can we do? And, well, then I'm going to introduce a notion of locality for detect chains that we can use to prove inexpressibility results. Particularly, what we want to do here is, we have a query and we want to say this query is not rewritable. Actually, how do we prove that? And to do that, we will use these notions of locality. And then I'm going to talk about query rewriting over the core. And here, what I want to do actually is to compare the expressive power of the canonical solution and the core. So the kind of question that I want to answer there is it true that if a query is rewritable over the core, it's also rewritable over the canonical solution? Or is the converse also true? Things like that. And if I have time, I will also talk about some extensions.
By the canonical solution, you mean the one obtained by the checks?
Yeah, I will define this precisely. Yeah, but that's the one. So, okay, let me talk about the query rewriting over the canonical solution. So, this is the way that we define the canonical solution. This is a simple algorithm that computes this canonical solution. So we have, remember, an input, we have a detection setting, source target, source schema, the relational schema, target schema, and a set of source to target dependency. And we have a source instance I. So how does this algorithm work? Well, it takes every source to target dependency in this set. Then for every tuple of constant A in the source, it verifies whether I satisfies phi of S of A, and if that is the case, well, it creates a fresh tuple of null values, that is a tuple of null values that have not been used, and then it inserts this set of tuples into J. Okay? So very simple. Let me give you an example. So for example, if we have, again, our running example, and we have employee Peter, employee Jon, what we do in this case is we take Peter, I mean, this formula is satisfied, so then we create a fresh null value X, and we insert department Peter X into J. Okay? And we do the same for John. So we create a fresh null value Y, and we insert department John Y into J. So this is the canonical solution in this case. Okay? And notice that the canonical solution is not unique, because it depends on the nulls that we are choosing. But all the canonical solutions that we can compute using this particular algorithm are going to be isomorphic. So we can talk about the canonical solution. Okay, so what is known about this transformation? So we call this transformation the F sub can. Okay, this is the canonical solution. What is known is that, well, first of all, it can be computed in polynomial time. And what is more important is this result for Fain, Colaitis, Miller, and Popa, that for every detection setting and union of conjunctive queries Q, there exists a query Q prime such that for every source instance, certain answer of qi is the same as q prime applied over the canonical solution. And what is this q prime? It's almost q, but if you remember from Fokin-Solaitis' tutorial, we have to remove tuples with null value. So how do we do that? Well, here we are going to assume that we have a built-in predicate that holds whenever x is a constant. So the rewriting of this query is going to be, well, exactly the same query q, and we also say that each of these values must be a constant, okay? So in this case, we can compute, actually, in polynomial time, we are talking about data complexity, the certain answers. But the other question is, well, can the theorem be extended to other classes of queries? And actually, Faith, Collecting, Miller, and Popa also proved that there exists a data exchange setting and a conjunctive query Q with one inequality such that Q is not first order rewritable over the canonical. What does it mean that? Actually, they show that this can be computed in polynomial time, so they have a polynomial time algorithm. But, it's a polynomial time algorithm, but it's not something that can be expressed in first order logic, or not necessarily. And actually, what does it mean that it's not first order rewritable? It means that no matter what is the target FO query that you take, Q prime, you are going to find some instant I such that certain of QI is going to be different from Q prime over the canonical. Okay? So you cannot rewrite that query. So, this is the problem that we would like to study. And in particular, we would like to have some tools, actually, that we can use to prove inexpressibility results. So how can we prove that the query is not first order rewritable? Okay, so how do we do that, actually? Before that, let me show you some simple facts about query rewriting. Well, something that is very easy to prove is that the problem of deciding whether an FO formula is FO rewritable over the canonical is undecided. Okay, this is very simple to prove. And it says that this is not a trivial problem, actually. And also, something that is important is that there exist other classes of queries that are first order rewritable over the canonical solution. It's not just a union of conjunctive queries. And one that is, that I personally like is that if you take the classes of queries whose asymptotic probability is zero, so we know that in first order logic, the asymptotic probability of every query is 0, 1. But here, take the class of all queries whose asymptotic probability is zero. So then all these queries are going to be FO rewritable, and this is because certain of QI is always false, actually. So they have a trivial rewriting. Okay, so what I'm going to introduce now is a tool to prove inexpressibility results. So, and this comes from finite model theory. So the idea here is the following. Let me introduce some notation. So we have a source instance I. So we say that the guy fan graph G of I, this source instance to be also target instance I, is the following. It has as domain the set, the active domain of I, the set of all elements that are mentioned in I. And we say that there exists an edge between A and B, these are two elements of the domain, if and only if A and B belong to the same tuple of a relation in I. So, for example, in this case, Gaifman graphs are not color graphs, it's just for the sake of clarity here. So, for example, in this case, we have an instance, and this is notation that we usually use to say that the value of the table R in I is to contain this tuple. This is the interpretation. So in this case, for example, in the Gaifman graph, if we have this tuple, we're going to have an edge between 1 and 2, 1 and 3, and 2 and 3. So the part that you can see here. Yeah. So here we have 1 and 4, and here we have 4 and 5. So this is the Gaifman graph of this structure. So we use this to define, actually, the following elements. So we say that the distance between A and B, two elements of this structure, is the distance between A and B in this Gaifman graph. We say that the distance of a tuple to a point is the minimum value of D sub I of AB, where A is in A. So we compute all the distances, and we take the minimum. And this is an important concept. We say that the neighborhood of A of radius D in this instance I is the restriction of I to the elements and distance at most D from I. Okay? So basically, for example, if we take this here, we're saying, take 5. Could be a tuple, but in this case, just one element. Take the elements that are distance 2. So if we go to 5, it's going to be 5, 4, and 1. So this is going to be the domain of this structure. Okay? And then take the restrictions of the table to this domain. So, for example, if you take a look to the tables here, you are going to see that this table is going to contain 1, 4, and 4, 5. Nothing changed here. But here, for example, we are not going to have this tuple because we don't have value 2 or 3. Okay? Okay, and the most important part. We say that two of these neighborhoods of radius D are isomorphic. Well, if there exists an isomorphism between these two neighborhoods, but that treat these elements A and B as distinguished elements. So what we are saying here, A is equal to A1 to AM, B is equal to B1 to BM. So then this isomorphism has to send A sub I to B sub I. Okay, these are constants in the structure. Okay, so what do we talk? We say that we are going to talk about locality, because basically what we are going to prove is that the values of certain answers depends on the neighborhoods of a point. So suppose that we have a data exchange setting S, T, and sigma sub S T, and we have an MARE query Q over T, any query. So we say that this query Q is locally source dependent if there is D greater or equal than zero, that only depends on Q, no, it doesn't depend on the instance, such that for every instance I of S and M tuples A and B in I, if it is the case that the D neighborhood of A is isomorphic to the D neighborhood of B, then A is going to be in certain answer of QI if and only B is in certain answer of QI. Okay? So basically what we are saying here, the neighborhood of this tuple determines whether this tuple is going to be in the answer or not. And notice that this D does not depend on I, okay? Just depends on the query, okay? So that's what we are saying there. Okay, so what is the main theorem here? The main theorem here is that if Q is first order rewritable over the canonical solution, then Q is locally source dependent. So we have this notion of locality, okay? And I will say how we prove this actually in the next slide, but let me show you first that this theorem can be used to prove an expressibility result, yeah? And particularly if a query is not locally source dependent, then it is not first order rewritable. So let me show you an example. And actually, we can use this tool to prove, results that are stronger than the original result that were proved by Fay, Kulaitis, Miller, and Popa. For example, we can prove that in a copy detection setting, for example, there are queries which, this is a disjunction of conjunctive queries with negations, which are not first order rewritable. So how do we do that? Okay, consider that we have this data exchange setting here. I'm saying that copying because this is lab and gap. I'm just copying the values of the relation in the source to the target. Yeah, I'm not doing anything else. And this is our query. So the question here is whether this query is first order rewritable. So if we assume that this query is first order rewritable over the canonical solution, then what we have is that there exists a D greater or equal than zero, such that if these two guys are isomorphic, then A is in certain answer of QI, if and only if B is in certain answer of QI. Yeah, very simple. So how do we find a contradiction? Well, we find a contradiction if we find a source instance I such that these two guys are isomorphic, this guy is in certain answer, and this guy is not. Yeah, very simple. So okay, let me do it here, just for the sake of completeness. So suppose that we have this particular instance. So these edges here are relation G, and this is in relation S we just have two values, A and B, and in the relation R we have just one value, which is this C here, okay? Okay, so if this is a sort instance, first we have to prove that A is in certain answer of QI, okay? So remember what is the query that we are posing is this one that is here, okay? So it's a disjunction. So in order to prove that, you can say, suppose that J does not satisfy the second disjunct, okay? So it does not satisfy S prime and this Boolean query here. Well, it does not satisfy, this J satisfies S prime because A was in S in the source instance. So it should be the case that it does not satisfy this one here, yeah? If it does not satisfy this one here, well, the negation of this says that for all Y and for all Z, if I is in the relation R prime and these two guys are connected by G prime, then Z must be in the relation R prime. So what you are going to see is that if we have R prime here, then we'll have R prime here, 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 here. Well, we will have it in all this circle. Okay? So in particular, we will have R prime of A. Yeah? So this J is going to satisfy the first disjunct. So what happened with B? Well, B is not in certain answer of QI. And why is that, actually? Well, this is a particular solution. And if you take a look to this particular solution does not satisfy this disjunction. And why is that? First of all, R of B is not true, actually. You see it here. And then, S prime of B is true, but if you think about this as a Boolean query, this Boolean query says that we have to find two points such that the first one is in R prime, these guys are connected by G prime, and the second one is not in R prime. And if you see here, we don't have any of this point here, and we don't have any of those points there. Yeah, all these points are in R prime. Okay. Okay. So one is in the certain answer, the other is not. And the problem here is that if you think about the neighborhoods, the neighborhood look exactly the same. If you think about the neighborhood of A and B in the source instance, and the neighborhood of radius D, this is the neighborhood of A, and this is the neighborhood of B. Okay. And these two are isomorphic. And actually, what was the difference in the original instance? What is this point here? But this point is too far. Actually, we cannot see it. I mean, if we take the neighborhoods of radius B. Okay. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about the proof of this. Actually, so what we know if we know that the hypothesis of the theorem is that the query is first order rewritable over the canonical, so what we know is that we can forget about certain answers and we just have a query, which is a first order query that we are posing on the canonical solution, okay? So what we know from Geismann theorem is that if you take two points A and B, there exists a number D that depends only on this first order rewriting or in this first order query such that if the D neighborhood of A is isomorphic to the D neighborhood of B, then this is in the answer to the query, if and only if this is in the answer to the query. So everything will be okay. But except that the problem here is that the neighborhood that we are considering are not in the target, are in the source. Yeah? If you remember the notion of locality that we are taking, we are talking about the R neighborhood or the D neighborhoods of this point A and B, but in the source. So, how do we solve the problem? So we have the Geismann theorem here, but we need to talk about the neighborhood here. So if we know that for this element D, D, there exists an R such that if these two guys are isomorphic here, then they are isomorphic here, we are done. Yeah, we have to consider this R, then we go to this D, and then we use Geismann theorem. But actually the problem here is that this is not the case, actually. You can find counterexamples, actually. So we cannot prove it that way. So what do we do? Actually, if you take a look to Geismann theorem, we can take a weaker notion. What we know from Geismann theorem is that for every first order formula, I think in this case the first order formula is the rewriting of the query that we are posing over the target. What we know is that there exists a D and a K such that if the D neighborhood of A and the D neighborhood of B play an NFR-friendly game for K rounds, then one is going to be in the answer to the query if and only if the other one is in the answer to the query. Which is the same to say that if this D neighborhood satisfies exactly the same first order sentences of quantifying rank up to K than this D neighborhood here, then they are undistinguishable by this particular first order formula. So, okay, so we change this. This is a weaker condition. So what we are asking now is, well, where for this D and K, we can find R and L such that if these two here satisfy exactly the same sentences of quantifier rank up to L, then these two here will satisfy exactly the same sentences of quantifier rank up to K. If that is the case, then we are done because we start from two neighborhoods that are isomorphic, then they will play this NFR-friendly game for L move, then they will play this for K move, then we use Geismann theorem. Okay? And actually that's the case. So this is a notion that this data exchange setting satisfied actually. So this is true in any of these data exchange settings that we are considering. So then we have the proof. Okay, if you want to see the details, all the details are actually in the paper that contain all this material is in POTS 2004.
Can I ask to what extent is the shape of the source to target dependency is essential? Can we change in any way? Can we generalize a little bit the source to target the mapping?
In this side we have first order formula, so we can. If we change, and in this side we just have conjunction. If we have more than conjunction, the problem is that it's not clear how to define the canonical solution. Like, for example, if you have a negation, what you do in this case? So that's the problem. So it could be the case that in this case you are not going to have locality just because you don't know what to choose, actually. That's the problem.
But on the left-hand side, you can have up to counting if you want.
No, 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 but it's a different thing. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, then you can look to other, like, logic that satisfies these properties here, yeah? So you can have counting and things like that. But the thing is that if you just want to stay in first order, if you add negation, it's not clear what are the transformations. That's the main problem, actually.
Well, I was just thinking, instead of having the canonical solution, you would just have some solution, let's say, miraculously.
Oh, okay. But if that solution is... it has to be generated in a deterministic way, first of all. And it could be the case that it's not true, actually. Okay, so let me talk about the query writing problem, but now over the core. Actually, just a couple of slides about the core. So the core of a canonical solution J, well, actually, I think that this is a much simpler definition, is the smallest solution that is homomorphically equivalent to the canonical solution. So it's a solution and you have homomorphism going both ways. And just to remember what's a homomorphism, in this case a homomorphism is a function that goes from J to J prime, actually from the active domain of J to the active domain of J prime, such that, well, it maps every constant to itself. And if you have a tuple, which is in table R in this structure J, then the image of this tuple should be in table R in the structure J prime, okay? So, and something that we know is that it can be computed in polynomial time. This is going to be the transformation that compute the core. We know that all the cores are isomorphic. I mean, you can rename the nulls and you will get yet another core. So the core is not unique. But since all of them are isomorphic, we can talk about the core. So what we know, and this is, the core was not defined in this paper, but in this paper, Fain, Colaitis, Miller, and Popper proved that for all universal solutions, we will have this property. So in particular, I mean, from there, we can conclude that for every detection set in a union of conjunctive queries Q, there exists a query Q prime, which is the same that I mentioned some at the beginning of the talk, such that for every source instance I, certain of Qi is equal to Q prime evaluated over the core. So, and certain answers can be computed more efficiently by using the core because the core is the smallest solution that is homomorphically equivalent. So the question is here, well, we want to study the same problem, but now over the core. Can we use locality? And let me say a few words about this, actually. If you think that, okay, we are going to see that these structures are also local, but if you think how to prove this, if you start proving this, trying to use something similar to what we did with the canonical, which is, okay, you start from some solution, for example, the canonical, you apply some transformation, and you prove that you can continue playing one of these Ehrenfeld-Frese games. The problem here is that the way that the core is constructed is very complicated. So you are taking homomorphisms, you are sending nulls to some elements, and you are reducing the size of the structure, and so on. So it's not very clear, actually, whether that's the right way to prove it. So what we wanted to do here, actually, was to prove something stronger, actually, and in particular to compare the expressive power of the core and the canonical, and to try to obtain the locality of the core from those results. So actually, I'm including this negative result here because for a long time we claimed that this actually, well, this is the negative version, but the negation of this proposition was true, actually. The good thing is that we didn't claim this in any paper, actually. We just, like, continued claiming that this was true. But it turned out that it was not, actually. So we were always saying that the core is not more than the canonical. What does it mean that? We were saying that you can compute the core of a detection setting by computing the canonical of a different one. But it turns out that's not true, actually. That there exists a detection setting A, such that for every detection setting B, you can find an instance such that, well, if you compute the canonical, the core here in this detection setting A is not going to be isomorphic to the canonical in this detection setting B. Okay, so what this thing is saying is, well, okay, you cannot compute the core using the canonical. Okay, so if that was the case, then we will have locality and everything will be easy. But that's not the case. So we need a different approach. And actually, what we can prove is that, well, if Q is FL rewritable over the core, then Q is also a co-rewritable over the canonical solution. And actually, there exists a polynomial time algorithm that, given a rewriting of Q over the core, finds a rewriting of Q over the canonical solution. And this is a polynomial time algorithm, but assuming that the detection setting is fixed. We're always talking about data complexity. And what is the corollary from this is that if Q is first order writable over the core, then Q is going to be locally source dependent. So we can use locality to prove properties about the core. Okay, so let me give you the idea how we prove that the every query that is rewritable over the core is also rewritable over the canonical. So let me take a particular example. So assume that this is we have a query Q, and we are assuming that this is the rewriting of Q over the core. So in this case, the query is there exists U such that for all B, psi of X UB, where this formula here is quantifier free. Okay. And I'm using an alternation of quantifier just to show, one of the main features of the proof. If this is a rewriting, what does it mean that? It means that for every source instant I and tuple of constant A is in certain answer of QI if and only if the core satisfies phi of A. Okay? So this is the first order rewriting. So, okay, assume that we have these two predicates here. So the first predicate, which is called alpha 1 of X, holds if there is a core of the canonical that contains the null value x. Okay? Suppose that someone give us that predicate. And we have alpha 2 of xy, which holds if there is a core of the canonical containing x and y. Okay? And, well, if this query has more quantifier, we will need alpha 3, alpha 4, but the important thing is we will always need a fixed number, yeah? Because it depends on the number of quantifiers that we have there. Okay. If alpha 1 of x and alpha 2 of xy are first order definable, if we can define that, then Q is F all rewritable over the canonical solution. And why is that? That's very simple, actually. A is in certain answer of QI, and that we know because this is a rewriting, if and only if the core satisfies there exists U such that for all B, phi of A, UB. Yeah? But this is if and only if the canonical satisfies the following formula. There exists U such that this U is in some core, and for every B, such that this B is in some core with U, we have we have the quantifier free formula is valid over A, U, and B. Okay? And why is that? Because all the cores are isomorphic, actually. So we don't care about, from where we are picking this point. So if these two formulas are FO definable, then we are done. So but the problem here is how do we define these formulas, actually? And notice that an important thing here is that we cannot test in first order logic where a structure is a core of a different structure. There is no way to do that. But here, we are testing just for a fixed number of elements because the query is fixed. We have 2, we have 3, we have 10, but it's just 10, actually. Okay, so I'm going to show you how to define alpha 1. And alpha 2 can be defined in terms of alpha 1 and some minor modifications. So how do you define alpha 1? Okay, we are going to use these elements that they were introduced by Feynman, Kolaitis, and pop up to get a polynomial time algorithm to compute the core that they were using also by Georg Gottlob to obtain a polynomial time algorithm that compute the cores for a cyclic tuple generating dependency. These are actually they're very useful. So what is this nouns of xj is the following. You do the following actually. This is a noun. Okay. So you construct the Geismann graph of j. Then you take the nouns of this J and you construct the graph induced by this nouns. So you will get a bunch of connected components of null values. And then nouns of XJ is all the nouns that are in the connected component that contain X. Okay, so Geismann graph, you induce from there you construct the graph that is induced by the null values. And then you will get a bunch of connected components which just have null values. And in nouns of XJ, you take all the elements that are in the connected component of this element X. And what is block of xj? Well, it's just a set of all tuples in j that contain a null value in this set nulls of xj. And what is important in this case is that since we are assuming that the detection setting is fixed, this guy and this guy both are bounded, actually. They have a fixed number of elements. That depends on the size of the detection setting, which is fixed in this case. And this is very important. That was important, actually, to get this polynomial time algorithm for computing the core, and it's also going to be important to define this formal alpha 1 in first-order logic. Okay, so we have to use this lemma. Actually, this is a very, very technical lemma. I will just give you an intuition here, but what I will try to convince you is that the condition that you get from this lemma is definable in first-order logic. That's an important thing. But what the condition says, okay, more or less, it says the following. here we have a null value x and a canonical solution j. What this lemma says is that there exists a core of J containing X if and only if all this long condition that we have here holds. And this long condition says the following. For every pair of target extractor G prime and G2 prime, such that these two extractors satisfy all these conditions that we have here. And what this condition says that, well, G, the size of G prime is more or less the size of the block of this guy, that you can find a homomorphism that goes from this block of a J, XJ to G, J prime, okay? So basically what you are saying is that you have a homomorphism that somehow replaces this guy by this guy. So somehow you can remove this when you are computing the core, yeah? Such that, well, X is not in the image of this homomorphism. So if you apply this homomorphism, X is not longer, I mean, or will not be in the core. And there is a third condition over this pair of extractors is this, that J prime is in between J prime and this union here. The important thing is this is of fixed size. If J prime union, well, you take all the nulls, and for all these nulls, you take the block of this guy. Yeah. See that J prime is just as, the size is bounded by this size, but it could contain nulls from different blocks. Okay, this is just, why do you need exactly this? It's a technicality. But the idea is that if you find this structure, so basically we're just saying, if we find a J prime which is going to be an alternative for this guy, then what it should happen is that there exists a homomorphism H prime that goes from this J2 prime to J such that X is a null of this guy. So basically, if you have a replacement, then you can apply another homomorphism and come back to this value. It's very technical, but what is the important thing here? The important thing here is the following.
Well, you used at least three second order quantifiers.
Yeah, that's the important thing, actually. Yeah, that's the key point here. Can we define this in first order logic? Well, if you think, I mean, yeah, we use a lot of second order quantification. So this is the question that we have to solve here. But the important thing is you can, actually. Why is that? Because you're saying, okay, here you have the first second order quantification, J prime and J2 prime, but the size of this guy is bounded. So you can use a fixed number of first order variables, actually, to quantify over this guy. And the size of this guy is also bounded. So again, you use a fixed number of first order variables and you have that guy. And then the other condition that you have to test is homomorphism. But again, these are fixed size guys. So you cannot test homomorphism for sort of logic, but you can do it here if you have fixed size structure. And the last thing that you have to check is whether there is a homomorphism from here to here. But if there is a homomorphism, it has to go to a substructure of fixed size because J2 prime is a fixed size. So it's also definable for sort of logic. No problem. And it's just because all these guys have fixed size, actually. So that's why it's it's first order definable. I hope that I convince you that you can define it, yeah? So that's the key point. So you can define this predicate. Okay. Okay, so what we know is that every query that is writable over the core will be writable over the canonical. So, but what about the inverse? Actually, the inverse is not true. So there exists an FO query that is FO rewritable over the canonical solution, but not over the core. And actually, from a expressiveness point of view, the canonical solution is better than the core, actually. So, we are always arguing that the core is better than the canonical, and it's right if you want to evaluate the query because it's smaller. But in terms of rewritability, the canonical solution is better than the core, actually. And you can say that the canonical solution somehow contains more information than the core. And it's the only thing that I'm saying here is that every query that is writable over the core is writable over the canonical, and the inverse is not necessarily true. Okay, so I have a bit of time, like 2 minutes. So let me talk about some extension. This will be very, brief. So, the usual certain answer semantics sometimes exhibit a counterintuitive behavior, and, well, most of the people argue that good solutions are universal solutions. So these are the solutions that are homomorphically equivalent to the canonical solution. So it could be the case that it's more meaningful to consider semantic based on universal solutions. So how do we define certain answers? Well, we take all the universal solutions, we compute the answer to the query, and then we take the intersection. But here we have a different semantics. So the question is, how do we prove results here? And actually, what is known about this universal solution semantics is that here we have a writability for a larger class of queries, actually. And this is from Fayes, Colitis, and Popa, that for every detection setting, an existential query Q, existential in this case, we can have negation, and no problem with that. there exists Q prime such that for every source instant I, U certain of Qi is equal to Q prime evaluated over the core. Okay? So the question again is, how do we prove, that the query is not rewritable in this setting? But the good news is that, I mean, all the previous results hold here, actually, hold trivially, because when we were proving locality, actually, we were just comparing the core and the canonical. And when we're doing that, we are not comparing the semantics, actually. We're not using anything from the semantics. So what is true here is that, well, you can define what does it mean to be locally source-dependent under the universal solution semantics. So you say that Q is locally source-dependent under the universal solution semantics. If you can find D such that if these two guys are isomorphic, then this will be U certain of Qi, if and only if this is in U certain of Qi. And all the previous results hold for the universal solution semantics. So if Q is F overwritable over the canonical solution or over the core under the universal solution semantics, then Q is locally source dependent under this universal solution semantics. And what is interesting actually is that if you come back to this theorem, from the theorem that says that every query writable over the core is writable over the canonical, you can infer that this is also true for the canonical. So in the universal solution semantics, every existential query Q is rewritable also over the canonical. I mean, the query that we're going to use is much longer. I mean, if you think about the construction that we did, you have to talk about homomorphisms, you have to talk about a lot of things, actually. But it's also rewritable, actually. Okay, just to finish, actually, we didn't mention target constraints here. Well, if we include target constraints, the problem is that locality is no longer valid, actually. So if you have tuple-generated dependencies in the target, then even with a single full target tuple-generated dependency, you will not have locality. And why is that? Because you can just prove transitive closure there. Yeah. So what is going to happen? You take, for example, a line, you copy it into the target, and then you use this constraint, and you get the linear order. So everything is at this one. Wow. For equality-generated dependencies, and this requires proof, what happens is that this is not true even for key dependencies. So even for key dependencies, which is the most simple type of equality-generating dependencies, you don't have a locality. Okay, just to conclude, so common data exchange transformations map similar neighborhoods into similar neighborhoods. This property can be used to formulate a locality notion for the canonical solution and the core. And locality can be used to prove that the core is not fully rewritable, and this holds also for other semantics, like the universal solution semantics. And something that I would like to say again is that from an expressiveness point of view, the canonical solution is better than the core. Yeah, that's it.
Questions?
So I will, again, going back to what I was, I'm sorry, I interrupted you several times, but you didn't seem to mind. So an interesting problem is one in which we try to extend the class of mappings, even if we just consider, for example, mappings in two directions or, you know, just. So it seems to me for the first time I see something, this notion of locality, where we could perhaps, you know, try to transcend the limitations on the mappings, at least to get some kind of inexpressibility results, which in itself is a good thing to have to stop enthusiasm sometimes, which is there is too much. So what do you think, just going back to my question, what chances would we have to formulate your locality theorem for a larger class of assertions that connect the source and the target?
Are these assertions definable in, like, what you think?
First order assertions, but not of this particular kind of form, which is a source to target. So first thing I would ask is, what if you have, for example, both a source-to-target inclusion dependency, and a target-to-source one, yes?
So that's an interesting problem. I don't know actually what happened in that case. Actually, not clear at all. But that's quite interesting actually. It could be that you have locality.
I'm just getting a sense that your method, you know, since they're using properties that are general for that hold for more general. Classes of first-order sentences, so might have a chance.
Yeah, actually, but could be the case that you can represent the problem with locality is that once you can represent the transitive closure, you are somehow done. Yeah? So if you have a set, like just thinking about the example, if you have something like phi of x implies, I don't know, phi of xy implies r of xy, and then you have a target to source, and in this target to source you do something like r of xy and r of y z implies something here, you copy just the first two values.
Sure, but you can break this, so, but somehow maybe some kind of conditions not unlike those that we have for some form of acyclicity, and it might
seem. Oh, yeah, that would be the case, yeah. Actually, yeah.
I don't know that weak acyclicity would work, but just.
Yeah. No, but it is an interesting question.
In some sense, what happens there, even with the simplest target to source, without target constraint,
mm-hmm.
then the problem becomes coin P complete.
Oh, okay.
So, certain answers. So in some sense, that tells you that this, it was in the last part of the second tutorial on PL data exchange.
No. Yeah, so I remember that, but I was
and they also, it also breaks down if, as Marcelo said, if on the antecedent, on the fee, you can put arbitrary first order and still do the exchange. But even if you put disjunctions on psi, again, you lose not only you lose the chase, but you also get NP completeness. You can incolorability.
Yeah.
I was thinking not for positive results, for negative results, to extend his theorem in such a way that we could use it to prove negative.
But for example, even in the case of disjunction, if you have a disjunction here, the problem here is that then you have non-determinism. So in one solution you can pick R, in a different solution you can pick S, for example, and then you will not have locality. I mean, the neighborhood will be different, actually. So the problem is that you will not have this notion. That's like the problem there. Yeah.